My guest today on the program hails from a country that starts with a C and ends with an Anada. I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers. I know you already figured it out. The podcast. Check this out.
Garden in my
the music of my guest today on the program, Abigail LaPelle. Let me tell you a little bit about Abigail LaPelle. Admittedly, I oversimplify it. There's a lot more to Abigail LaPelle's story than simply being from Canada. Abigail LaPelle has one of the most arresting voices in modern music. The Canadian-born singer-songwriter has been on an undeniable winning streak since her 2011 debut album, Survivor. She followed that up with stunners like 2017's Hide Nor Hair, 2022's Stolen Time, and a brand new one, Anniversary. We'll get to Anniversary in a second, but before we do, here are a few things to know about Abigail. Aside from snaring honors like the Canadian Folk Music Award and the Colleen Peterson Songwriting Award, the Toronto-based musician has scored a Canadian folk radio number one, logged close to 50 million streams on all digital platforms, and has been quietly forging a reputation as a heart-stopping live performer, knocking people out at South by Southwest, the Edmonton Folk Fest, and Pop Montreal. Back to Anniversary, the new album was recorded with Tony Decker of the Great Lakes Swimmers in a 200-year-old church in Niagara-on-the-Lake, and it's a riveting listen. Filled with haunting percussion, musical precision, and folky finesse, Anniversary is one of the most achingly beautiful albums of the year. And Abigail, well, she's just awesome. So let's meet her. Here's me and Abigail LaPelle having a conversation right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
I just got back from Western Canada, and I've got about 4/5 weeks off right now, and I'm going back sort of across Canada, coast to coast, so it feels very luxurious. I've got a few minutes at home, and I just moved, so I'm sort of doing some nesting and like being very antisocial for the next few weeks.
Is it part of it that you know when you're going to be playing shows that you have to give a lot of yourself? So is this a kind of like a charging up kind of space?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit of me time. I mean, by antisocial, I mean, like I'm hanging out with friends, and like, you know, going for nice walks and stuff like that. But yeah, it's definitely, I really cherish the quiet time.
But peeking over your shoulder is your guitar.
Oh, this is my partner's weird guitar, actually. Yeah, this is like this very odd, I don't know what brand it is. It's pretty strange. It's got this like neck, I don't know. It's really hard to play, but it sounds good.
It has like a, it looks like the neck is super wide. Is that right?
Yeah, the neck is pretty wide. Well, is it? It's not crazy big, but yeah, I don't think there's a truss rod actually. So yeah, it's pretty thick. It just has a strange, like, look at the angle of that. It's almost kind of tipped forward and then has this really cool pick guard. I don't know where he got this thing, but it's kind of just a wall hanger, and we've tried to kind of fix it up over the years, but yeah, anyways.
Well, it looks like it sounds beautiful.
It sounds like it looks. It sounds like very woody and warm. And
in terms of getting settled, I've found that artistic people, if they've just moved or if the house is a mess, they can't create. They have to be settled before they create. Or, right, are you one of those people, and as you're getting, so you've said you recently moved, are you one of those people where the house kind of has to be in order for the creative space to have the space it needs to kind of breathe?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it helps for sure. And like having a bit of routine. Like I said, even just being home for a few weeks, it feels like such a luxury to be able to like plan out, you know, a day or a week and slot in some time to work on music or just like household chores. But that said, I don't know, like I do a lot of writing just like on the road and in those moments in between things too. Like I don't smoke anymore, but I used to be a smoker, and that was when I got like so much of my best writing done, would be just standing outside a club and I would have, you know, like 10 minutes to myself, and I would end up humming a little ditty while smoking. And so I think it can be both. I think about this a lot, actually, because there's like, I've been lucky enough to do some writing residencies or writing retreats where you have like solid, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks to just write, and someone else is taking care of all your meals and earthly concerns. And that is such a gift. It feels like such a luxury. And then other times it's like crazy busy and you just have 10 minutes at the end of the day to pick up a guitar and noodle. And that can be such a productive time too. So I don't know, actually. I think there's kind of a, for me at least, there's sort of a dichotomy between those two things. Like it can be, yeah, there can be pros and cons to both, actually.
Those writing retreats, I'm a writer, and those retreats, they fill me with anxiety because it's like, now you better write because now you're here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the pressure's on.
How'd you do with that?
I think I just sort of tried to accept that it's all part of the process. Like I would go for a lot of long walks on my writing retreat, and I would have to like just really accept that that was productive, or just resting, like just literally sleeping. And like that you sort of have to embrace not being productive, ironically, I guess, in order to achieve productivity sometimes. And yeah, just kind of letting it go, like, because writing, it's so intense, like, and like you said, like, I would have such a higher, like, I would feel like I had failed if I had spent fewer than, like, 5 or 6 hours writing, whereas on a normal day, I would feel amazing if I got in, like, a good hour. So yeah, I think, and that's kind of what I mean, is it's like, I think it's really nice to have both, because there can be pros and cons to both. But the new album that's coming out was written, I'd never worked like this before. I just went away to the mountains and like literally just wrote an album pretty much from scratch, or some of it was half finished and sort of half baked ideas, but I'd never gone in with that sort of intention and just written something. And then we went and recorded it like the next month, basically. So it was an interesting way to do it, for sure. The retreat that I did last year was at the Banff Center in the Canadian Rockies, which, if you ever get a chance, it's a really beautiful place. But it's kind of, how would you say it? It's relatively luxurious. Like, you don't have to shovel any snow or anything. You kind of live in a nice hotel, basically, and you have a little studio in the woods, and everything is kind of taken care of for you. So that's really, yeah, that's that was, for me personally, that was a nice way to do it. I've tried to do more like self-directed writing times and found it challenging either because, yeah, I was just kind of keeping busy. Or I would just like read all day. But even then, I think, well, that's lovely. Like, that's very helpful as a writer. So I don't know. I guess I just try not to be too hard on myself.
I like what you said, though, about it's a very cool image of you. It's a very cool image of you actually standing outside a club, smoking a cigarette and writing a song. That's pretty cool. And I also feel sometimes I'm a teacher and sometimes I'll write between classes. And when you kind of squeeze out those sparks in moments where you're not supposed to find those sparks, there's something kind of rewarding about that kind of edgy quality of writing.
Absolutely. And when time is scarce, it feels more precious sometimes. So I don't know, it tends to be, whereas yeah, if you're staring out at this gaping month of unstructured time, it can be a bit overwhelming.
I think you just hit it on the head. I think that's exactly what it is. And by the way, I'm not saying I want you to start smoking again. I'm just saying.
Right. You know what else too? This is crazy, but I used to take the Greyhound bus. I didn't have a driver's license and I didn't have any money. And when I was young, I would go on tour across Canada on the bus, which it doesn't even run anymore, sadly, but you could get like a pass for the month to go to just like get on and off any bus line. So I would take these crazy bus trips. Like I'd be on the bus for 16 hours or something. And I would just sit and write. And there was no, you know, smartphones or internet at that time. So it was truly this very liminal, like no connection to the real world. And I found that was a really nice place to write too, and kind of like sing to myself and hope that people couldn't overhear me too much. I think that was bonkers.
I love what you do. I love your music. You capture this kind of stillness in your work that is just, it's stunning to me. And it reminds me of people like Patty Griffin or Gillian Welch, I think comes up a lot when people talk about your work. I just love it. And I think I'm wondering for you growing up, you grew up in Toronto? Is that where you're originally from?
Yep.
Yeah. Growing up, were there people where you went, I want to be like that. This is the music that's really connecting with me. Did you have sort of North Star heroes that really were important to you in terms of your own development?
I really loved Cat Power. I think I just found her music was so, this is like in the 90s, like the early 2000s. Like I found it so raw. It just sounded like someone like me, like just kind of sitting in your bedroom playing music and someone, you know, had pointed a mic at it. And I felt like that kind of thing was always the most powerful to me. Just really, yeah. Very homemade. My favorite singer growing up was Sinead O'Connor, R.I.P. And it was kind of the same thing, although it's kind of funny to say that because it has all that 80s, 90s like production, but just her way of singing really cut through that. And it was so raw and, you know, relative to other pop music of the time, just like seemed very confessional and very real to me. So those are two of the people that I definitely like tried to sound like as a singer.
Those are also two people where if I hear them, I have to stop what I'm doing. Like I can't.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't, if they're on in the store, you can't just keep shopping. You just have to stop. They just stopped me in my tracks. Two absolutely beautiful singers.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And then at some point, I just remember discovering Gillian Welch and just my mind being so blown. Kind of in a similar, not similar like genre-wise, but yeah, just very simple, like songs that just sound like they've always existed and really easy delivery, very natural.
Do you miss the democracy of a band, or do you like being alone and, you know, being you being sort of the play caller?
That's a good question. I don't have a lot to compare it to because I never really had a band. I sort of played in other people's bands, and then I would kind of have I spent a lot of time living in Montreal, and I just feel like there were so many bands, but there weren't they weren't super collaborative. Like, it was really like my band that had other people in it, or vice versa. I would be kind of a side player for someone else. So all that to say, like, I think about this a lot as a solo artist, because I'm touring more with a full band, and I don't know, the dynamics of it, I think, are challenging either way. Like, it's, there's kind of good and bad to both, I would think. But I haven't had a lot of, like, I've never had like a, you know, a writing partner where we were writing together or stuff like that. So I have a lot of really great collaborators, and I really value their input, but I'm also such a loner as a writer. So maybe that's a better path for me personally at this point.
Being a loner as a writer and also being a good collaborator musically, is they kind of go hand in hand, don't they?
Yeah, maybe. Because then you're sort of, or for me, like, I'm very, by the time it gets to the stage of like sharing the music and wanting feedback and arrangements, by that point, I'm usually very eager to hear people's input and get a bit of a back and forth. But I'm also pretty solid in what I think things work or don't work. So yeah, maybe it's good for me to kind of be the boss. But it's such a revolving door, especially now, like getting ready to tour. It's always kind of different people. And it can be, just the logistics of it can be challenging. But then I think there's good sides to it too, because it's really great branching out and sort of working with new people and getting out of my comfort zone a bit.
Do you have, you know, what you do for a living is very specific and hard to understand probably for people who aren't in the industry, you know, in terms of like, you hear fans, I saw Feist the other night here in San Francisco, who was remarkable.
Oh, cool. Yeah, she's playing here in a couple days, actually.
Oh, my God. I put her in that category of people who stop you in your tracks. It's so, yeah. Right, amazing.
True.
Just incredible. But I feel like I heard someone say next to me, like, oh, I can't wait for her to come back, right? And it's like, she's not coming back tomorrow. There's a cycle to what she's doing, and then it might be a couple of years before she makes it back to San Francisco. I feel like people don't quite understand sometimes how difficult it can be, how expensive it can be to be a musician. It looks like magic. You bring your magic carpet show to a city, and then the next city, and then you come back. Do you have friends that do what you do for a living that you commiserate with and talk about the life of a musician with?
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes it feels like that's all we talk about. Yep. I did a tour in the fall with Great Lake Swimmers, and it was kind of like, you know, like bigger rooms than I would play, and it's a bigger band, like just more logistics. And it was actually really heartening chatting with those guys and seeing that it's, you know, it's kind of a lot of the same, whatever, like, quote unquote, level you are at as a performer, what size of rooms you're playing, you kind of have to deal with like the same bullshit. And that is, in a way, I guess I take comfort in that, or maybe I'm just a masochist, but it feels like it is really challenging. And then hopefully it just looks effortless. So,
I had Tony on the show. He's just a really lovely guy. Did you pick up any wisdom from him being around him?
Yeah. I mean, I said this to him, I've just felt like, I don't know how to say it. I just felt that he was so kind to everyone in the band. And it felt like there was such a good, for lack of a better word, just like a really good vibe on that tour. And obviously things go wrong and schedules run late or people get sick or all kinds of things go wrong. And I just felt like he didn't lose his cool and was, it just felt like that thing where if the boss is an asshole, it just kind of trickles down and everyone's kind of on edge. It's kind of like the opposite of that, where if the sort of leadership and the person on top, because he was also basically tour managing that tour. And I just remember feeling like I really have a lot to learn about just kind of keeping my cool. I mean, I'm not like an asshole to people, but it's helpful to see an example of yeah, just that kindness and really respect for people that just makes everything run smoother. Because things are going to go wrong, and you know, there's at a certain point, you just have to roll with it. So I'm working on it.
Yeah, that's easier said than done, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you tend to get thrown off by when things go a little south?
Yeah, and I just don't have as much experience tour managing, like being in charge of a large group of people and coordinating everyone's travel. And then when things go wrong, like last summer, we had all these dates that got canceled because of the wildfires in Western Canada and British Columbia. And I just didn't cancel things. Like I just didn't understand. This is a very specific example, but I feel like in hindsight, I would have just canceled those shows immediately. Whereas I was kind of waiting. I was trying to make things work. I just think I was trying too hard to make things work. So it's more a case of that. Like I can be a bit relentless, which, you know, there's a time and a place for that. But so many other bands I talked to, and it was like at the same festival or touring in the same region, like they just canceled the dates because it was that was obviously the right move. And I didn't even, it never even occurred to me. I was like trying to save money. Like I would have lost less money if I had just, so anyway, this is, we don't need to get into the weeds, but the point being is it's just that thing of like accepting, like, okay, if things are going to be canceled, they're going to be canceled. Like it can make it a lot worse if you're always trying to like push so hard. You know what I mean?
But that relentlessness you're talking about, that relentlessness to me sounds like someone who's relentlessly optimistic. Like you were like, we can maybe do this.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's where having a more of a democracy within the band would maybe be helpful too, because I feel like they might have more insight in a situation like that. Like if I'm working with people that have been touring musicians all their lives, they might be better able to take a step back and just see like this isn't going to work. And so, you know, all that to say, it's also easy with hindsight, I guess, to see what you could have done differently. But yeah, I feel like it's just a learning process, I think. I just don't think about canceling things, actually. Like it never would have even crossed my mind. And I've been really working on that. It's not good to cancel things, but like I'm just getting a little more mindful about maybe saying no to things, or, you know, I think that's actually a really big lesson to try to learn.
I was going to ask you about that, because that's something that I didn't know how to do until fairly recently. And
real skill.
Oh my God, it's only a two-letter word and I couldn't say it for the first 50 years of my life. Once you start saying it and you almost, it's all, you know, you're advocating for yourself by saying no.
Totally. I heard a really good piece of wisdom from another artist who was saying she doesn't give a reason to say no to things. I mean, I'm sure there's exceptions, but meaning like, don't say like, I can't do it because X, Y, and Z. Just say, and you can still be nice about it, but just say like, I'm going to have to pass. Best of luck. Just like, don't get into the weeds. Like, just keep it real, real simple. So I think that can be helpful.
That's brilliant advice, because I think in the old days, it was almost like you had to come up with something that was legitimate enough where no one's going to argue with you, right? Like, well, that's not a good enough reason to say no. Everyone has the stomach flu or whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah. But if you don't give a reason, there's no argument.
That's right.
And even within yourself, I think. Because then you'll start, I don't know, for me at least, I might start arguing with myself. Well, I have the flu, but like I've played a show before when I had the flu. Like it just spirals, you know, whereas if you just keep it to a clean, it's almost just more for my own benefit. I find that can be a really helpful way to think about it. I'm just going to have to pass.
Everywhere we go, you know, everyone, people say hello.
can you explain to me, and this is take this from someone who doesn't even understand iambic pentameter, tempo rumba. I tried to learn it and understand it, but I need you to explain it to me because I don't get it, but I'm interested.
I don't know what that is. Oh, rubato? Tempo rubato? Or
yes, I even pronounced it incorrectly. Oh. Yeah.
No, I think it just means like not in time. So tempo rubato literally means robbed time, but I think it just means not following like a metronome style rigid tempo, but rather having a push and a pull and a slowing down and speeding up. I'm moving my hand. It's a famously visual medium of podcasting. But I just loved that term. I was during COVID when everything was locked down here. I got some books from the library and was learning some piano. And there was a little section on tempo rubato. And I felt like, and then someone in my band made fun of me because I pronounced it tempo rubato. So take that for whatever it's worth. But I find that so interesting. And because that's what music, that's such a, yeah, I mean, it's a cool, I think it's a cool sounding term, stolen time. But it's also something that's really important to me. Like the last couple of albums, we didn't have any click tracks. It was very much kind of live in the room. And I tend to vary, depending on the song, but my music has a lot of that push and pull. And when I try to rein it in, it's often really noticeable how much less impactful it feels. So yeah, that one really spoke to me.
Does it refer to the music or the lyrics or both?
Oh, the tempo, like, so just the beat. I think just means the beat. So instead of a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, you could have like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Just like more of a loose rhythm, slowing down and speeding up. And
how does that inform the writing process? That awareness, did that change anything for you in terms of how you write?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it changed. Like, I don't really have much formal music training. So it's one of those things, I think it's like fun to learn a term for a concept that is already like so intuitive. And I've always had people I play. I mean, I know it more so playing with other people, obviously, because I have to like warn them, like, this is going to have this real, there's going to be some real drama and like, it's going to slow way down and then, you know, speed up. And especially at the end, which I think is called, what's it called at the end of a song when you really like slow it down? Is that a cadence? Anyways, so yeah, I don't know if it's changed how I write, but it's definitely interesting to be aware of how much of that is going on and notice it in my own music. And I think I've come to actually really value that, because I, like I said, I don't have much, you know, formal music training, and I tend to play with people that are very knowledgeable and have, you know, a ton of education. And that's one of the things, it sounds a little bit vain, but that's something I feel like I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on from my more knowledgeable musician friends, is like, oh, that's such an interesting way of playing with time or something like that. And of course it's different than just not having good rhythm. So I guess that's an interesting distinction. Like, you could be trying to play to the beat and failing versus like deliberately, playing with time in this way that there's something like almost kind of godlike about that. Just the idea of playing with time and stretching and contracting time. And then also, like, we're not a metronome. Like, people are not, this is a whole other thing, but like, not playing with a click is like, it seems crazy to me that you would use a click track, actually. although it's, I mean, to me, I guess it's a tool, like there's a time and a place for it. But again, I've just really come to value that there's going to be this natural push and pull. And like, if the song speeds up a bit, that then, you know, want to just let the song speed up a bit. But, you know, maybe it's a fine line, or maybe there's obviously styles and genres of music that use beats that are more programmed. And so that's a whole other conversation, I guess. But anyway, I think it's such an interesting topic. I think it's such a basic, like, actually human, like, fundamental thing, like keeping a beat, but in a human way that is like a heartbeat or a, you know, like a rhythm, like the rhythm of the Greyhound bus.
Right.
So yeah, I find it really fascinating.
But even, I like what you're saying about how life is not a click track. It's not, we're not steady. Our heartbeat goes up and down throughout the day a billion times. The Greyhound bus stops and starts. It didn't change the way you write, but did it change the way you listen, where you hear music and go, oh, I recognize it there. It's happening there now.
Yeah, I think so. Especially listening to like older music that is obviously not recorded on a grid with a click, is you kind of notice, yeah, there'll be just a lot more freedom. There'll be these little, I think it's called flamming, when the drums are kind of just like outside the groove in a certain way, where it like rubs up against the rest of the band. And that's like such a beautiful thing, but you can't have that, you know, if you're just playing like a metronome, you kind of have this tension. That's so interesting. So yeah, I definitely try to listen for that kind of thing.
Do you love playing live? Is that a really, feel like a really safe, great place to be for you? And did it take you time to develop that? Feel like you're in that kind of pocket? Was it always natural for you? It's like, I'm just rapid firing 12 questions at once, but did the live setting always feel good to you as a performer?
Not really. I mean, I find it really challenging to perform live, but I guess it's kind of a love-hate. Maybe not hate. It's a love slash really, I find, challenging. I get really nervous to play live, but then that can be kind of thrilling. So that can be a good thing, I think. So I guess I kind of enjoy the challenge of it. But it's all those other things, like what we were saying earlier, just all the logistics of touring. I feel like that can really affect things in a good or bad way, like whether or not you have a nice, you know, just like somewhere comfortable to sleep the night before and
yeah,
stuff like that. And like playing with a band is so different versus playing solo, and so there's different challenges to both of those. But I do really love it. I mean, when it's good, it's like that's the best thing. So I guess that's the goal, at least.
Yeah, I think, you know, the composing of art is such a private thing to do. It's, you do it alone in a solitary situation, whether you're, you know, standing outside a club writing in stolen time, or you're at a retreat, or you're still by yourself if you're on a train, whatever. When you're performing it, you're being stared at. It's like you've gone public with the thing that's really quite private. And so you're singing something which was composed in a solitude, and now you're being stared at while you're playing the thing that you composed in solitude. It seems very vulnerable and very exposed. Is that sort of around the nervousness, or sort of like, yikes, all eyes are on me? Or are you okay with that aspect of it?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I think, again, I just think it's kind of this like dichotomy, because so many performers are such introverted, shy people, and yet you're doing this very public thing. So it seems kind of contradictory. And that's how I feel about it. Like, I don't mind, because I guess on some level it's like, well, it's nice to get attention. But then, like, I feel like I'm trying to do a good job, and that's like the worst thing. You don't want to be thinking about doing a good performance. You're sort of my partner who works in the music industry, although he's not a musician, but he always says it's like good music is when you're not thinking about it. And then if you're thinking about trying to do a good job, especially as a singer, I feel, because it's so embodied and it's like such a, yeah, very personal. It's like literally just like your guts spilling out. Maybe not literally, but kind of like it's really, if you're nervous, like you can just hear that vibration. So I don't know if that answers the question. Like I find it's just kind of another weird contradiction. Cause I really love performing. I guess I just feel, why do I feel nervous? Like I just feel like I'm going to, I don't know why. It's yeah. Not a very coherent answer. Because it doesn't really matter. Like I was talking to my friend about this who I play with, who comes more from the classical world originally. And she was like, well, those kinds of performances, it's like you have to be perfect. Like then you feel that pressure. Mm-hmm. And then playing in an indie rock band or playing folk music, it's like, that's not what it is. It's not like I think if I make a mistake. And plus I'm a pretty good player. Like I'm not going to make like that much of a mistake. And if I do, like, I kind of don't care that much. No one else does either. So it's not that. It's not that it's like I want it to be perfect. It's just that I want it to be good in a certain way. And it's not always. And it's better just not to think about being good, I guess. I'm not sure. Does that make any kind of sense?
It does. I teach university and there are moments where when I'm teaching, if I'm in the pocket, the class becomes an organism. And like yeah. When I move this way, they move with me. And when I move this way, they move, right? Other times, they're a fractured set of people on their phones who hate me, right? It's one or the other. And I feel like it mostly is the second one. But I think that the best shows I've been to, like with Feist the other night, they just moved where she moved. They were an organism. And that's that moment where I think you know you've got the audience. They're yours. And it seems like if there was any kind of nerves at all, once you have that realization of like, I got them, I'm in. And then it seems like everything is just smooth after that. Are you aware? Are you conscious of the moment where you go, well, I think this crowd is with me. I think I've got this crowd right now.
Yeah. And I think that is what it is. Cause then you're not thinking about it in the same way. Then it just kind of feels like everyone's along for the ride, as opposed to trying to win people over, which is not a good place to be coming from, I guess, in any scenario.
No, because I don't think you can leave that place. Because I don't think there's, if you're trying to win them over, you're up to the very end, you're going to still be trying. I don't think you know?
Yeah. And don't you think it's almost too, like, whatever size of performance or room, there's like this thing about trust. Like you want to trust that the person on stage is kind of has you. Like they're not, like I try really hard not to say a lot of self-deprecating comments, which is something we all do at times. And I used to do a lot on stage and apologize. And then I started noticing as an audience member, like that's so uncomfortable. I mean, you can make a little self-deprecating banter here and there. It's fine. But like if someone is really in that place of like not, it's just like very, it's not generous. Like it's not being generous to the audience. Like you should be not asking them for something without being willing to like give something. I don't know. I don't know how to say it, but there's something about, you want to feel like you can trust the person that's on stage, whatever their style might be. Like maybe they're really cool or maybe they're really goofy and whatever it is, but maybe it's mutually just trusting each other to like let go and just kind of be in, like you said, be sort of joined up into one organism.
And you have an advantage, I think, over me as a teacher, because I think that people are there because they already love you or are curious about you. And
So I feel you're already halfway there. They're rooting for you. They, you know, whereas with me, they're like, I got to take this class with this guy, you know? So winning them over is from a place, I think you have a jump on me by 50% or more. So they're, you know, they're rooting for you anyway. They're on your side, right?
Yeah, that's true. You have that. It's kind of like it's yours to lose. Like you have that goodwill from the beginning, hopefully. Yeah, it's so interesting. I find it challenging to talk about because I don't really know what exactly is happening in those moments. Sometimes you're just not feeling it, or vice versa.
It's yours to lose. And so that's a pretty advantageous position, I think, to start from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could still go south, of course.
No, it's such a good point, though, because people are rooting for you. No one wants to have a bad time. Even when you're the opener and no one's heard of you, or it's whatever the context like that, where people aren't necessarily there to see you. But people want to have a good experience. So you sort of do have a lot of goodwill. But yeah, it's interesting.
In terms of this album, I've had to be very conscious of this because I unconsciously stopped doing it, listening to music, an album front to back. You know, where I'm older than you, but you certainly can remember the days of like, here's the new Cat Power, I'm listening to it start to finish, right?
Absolutely.
And now it's sort of like, you know, here's a song and here's a this. I'm going back to the idea of, you know, treating an album like a novel. Don't just pull pieces apart and take what you want. When you were sequencing this record, did you think in terms of a narrative arc of a beginning, a middle, and an end?
I don't know if I would call it a narrative arc, but for sure, we talked a lot about the sequence and maybe more so just the... I wouldn't say it was super narratively conceived, but just thinking about what songs kind of led into other songs and the whole thing as a whole. We talked about that a lot, and like actually really early in the process, like even in the recording sessions, I remember just kind of, you know, just chatting about this one would be a good first song, and this one would be a good last song, and this one would be good after this. And like, and me and Tony, who co-produced the record, like we went back and forth a lot about the sequence, and he was like so thoughtful about that stuff. But I'd never thought about it that early in the process before. And the last record I did, I worked with Howard Billerman in Montreal, and he was like, it was almost kind of the opposite. He was like, well, wait till it's mixed. He put everything in alphabetical order, which surprisingly kind of worked pretty well. But he was like, once it's mixed, even like once it's mastered, like then we'll start maybe thinking about the sequence. For whatever reason, that was just how he found. But it's cool though, and it is really fun and challenging to think about the album in that way, especially knowing that to some extent not no one, but it's so much more rare now, like you said, to listen to it as a whole. And I even too, like with the vinyl, because I'm always thinking about the side A and side B, and like it's a bit pretentious, but on the CD version of this record, I like kept the listing as like a side A and side B, even though obviously that is not the case physically, but I just kind of like the look of it visually, and I just thought it does kind of make sense. It's like these two little mini EPs together. And there's also technical considerations, like it's better to have the last song be slower on vinyl because the grooves are whatever too small, tighter, and it's like a smaller circumference. So yeah, I find all that stuff really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I used to have conversations with my friends, like, what's the best album closer of all time? And I kind of missed those conversations. I miss thinking about music as a piece and not as pieces.
Right. And what are you listening on vinyl or just digitally, but all in one?
I'm doing digitally, but I'm just like doing one album and carrying it around with me now.
Right.
You know, I want to listen to, I want the whole experience. And I just think that's, how about you? Are you doing it that way too? Are you listening to albums front to back, or have you?
Lately I've been, we've been just putting something on and then like letting the algorithm choose a playlist based on that, which it just sort of evil, but it surprisingly can be really great. And my partner only able to listen to Tidal because it's like better quality. So yeah, we'll just put on like a seed, quote unquote, and then let it algorithm out from there. But yeah, there are certain albums for sure that I'll always listen front to back. And like, no, it's a good, I mean, it's the same with everything too. Like even sort of reading long form things, I feel is like a dying art. And, I think it's definitely worth, putting in the effort.
I think what you're saying works when you put it on and then you go, wait, what was that? And then you have to run and find out. That's kind of a cool moment. I mean, that's the new version of hearing something on the radio and saying, what was that? Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Has anything, what was that at you recently? Have you?
Oh, from like just finding something from an album? Yeah. I started listening to Mountain Man, which is, are they from the Bay Area, actually? I don't know.
I don't know who they are.
It's someone, I can't think of their name, from Sylvan Esso. And, but it's this very like, I don't know, it's really lo-fi, like, it sounds like old timey music, but like very, it's very contemporary and it's very minimal. And it was so beautiful. And then I definitely went down a rabbit hole with it, but I'd never heard their music. I can't remember what I was listening to and it came on. And then I was like, all right, I got to just binge this for a while. It's so minimal that it made me kind of question everything. Like there'll be one song that's just voices. It's a lot of vocal harmonies, like really beautiful, but there'll be just like a bass line being played on a guitar string and like no other instrumentation. We're just like super, super simple.
So super primitive almost in the approach.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. When that moment happens, Abigail, when I go, what is that? It makes me really happy to know I can still fall in love organically. Like something can still bolt out of the blue and make me go, holy cow. I love that.
Yeah, I love that too. And then isn't it funny when you go back to something like some of the music that I found so moving as a younger person, like sometimes, not always, but often it has like almost no effect on me. And it's like being in love. And then it's like, well, am I still even capable of that feeling? And then, yeah, like you said, when something new grabs you that way, it's so gratifying to just feel like I can just be in love with life in a really particular way.
There you go. Abigail LaPelle. She's super cool. Her album is just beautiful. Go grab it. AbigailLaPelle.com is where you need to go to find it. You can also go to AbigailLaPelle.bandcamp.com. Check out AlexGreenBooks.com to find out what's happening in my literary career. You can follow me on what's left of Twitter at Embers Editor or on Instagram at Embers Podcast, or just email me editor@StereoEmbersMagazine.com. Stereo Embers, the podcast, is available on all podcast platforms. Go to the one that you use, you know, like the one you're listening to this program on right now. Rate and review. Tell all your friends. We would appreciate it. Oh, if you feel like subscribing, that wouldn't hurt either. BombshellRadio.com is where you got to go to find out what's happening with our radio station. I think that's it. Let's close the show with a longer listen to Count on Me by Abigail LaPelle from her wonderful new album. This is a percussive, gorgeous, stone-cold stunner of a song. Check it out, enjoy it, and thank you, as always, for listening to Stereo Embers, the podcast, only right here on Bombshell Radio. Garden.
Sky.